Good afternoon. Let's go ahead and get started. My name is William A. Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State, and I'm conducting this hearing on behalf of Secretary of State Gigi Dennis under the authority granted the Secretary of State in 1-4-909 CRS. This hearing concerns objections submitted to the Secretary of State concerning the Secretary of State's statement of insufficiency concerning the candidate petition of Mark Holtzman for nomination at the August primary election as the Republican candidate for governor. On June 1, 2006, the Secretary of State notified Mr. Holtzman that the Secretary of State had determined that his candidate petition contained an insufficient number of eligible electors' signatures for certification to the primary election ballot. On June 6, 2006, Mr. Holtzman, by counsel, submitted a letter to the Secretary of State notifying her of his objections to the Secretary's statement of insufficiency. Although the letter was submitted within the 5-day period required for filing a protest under Section 1-4-909, the letter explains the position of Mr. Holtzman that Section 1-4-909 only covers objections to a statement of sufficiency. And since in this case the Secretary of State issued a statement of insufficiency, the letter concluded that, quote, there is no basis for any further proceeding before the Secretary of State regarding these petitions. The Secretary of State received two other filings that were formally denominated as protests of the Secretary of State's statement of insufficiency pursuant to 1-4-909. Both were received within the 5-day requirement of Section 1-4-909. One protest was submitted on behalf of electors Castilian, Woodis, Hoppe, and Worley by Counsel Michael J. Norton and Douglas H. Benevento. Included with the protest were various exhibits in both CD and printed form that are a part of the record. Another protest was submitted on behalf of candidate Bob Beaupre by counsel Scott Gessler and Hugh Thatcher. This office issued a notice of this hearing on June 6th to Mr. Holtzman, Mr. Beaupre, and electors Castilian, Woodis, Hoppe, and Worley. The notice set the hearing on this matter for today at this time and location, and the notice of hearing will be made a part of the record. Section 2421-108 provides that the Administrative Procedures Act does not necessarily apply to hearings relating to candidate petitions. However, I do intend to apply whatever procedural rules are necessary to conduct a fair and expeditious hearing. For the record, I'd also like to note that on Monday, June 5th, I issued a memorandum to the parties to set out my expectations concerning the protest that might be filed in connection with the candidate petition of Mr. Holtzman. That memorandum is an exhibit to Mr. Beaupre's protest and is therefore part of the record of this hearing as well. Next, I'd like to give an opportunity for counsel to introduce themselves for the records, perhaps starting with counsel for Mr. Holtzman. Just enter your appearances, if you would, if you're prepared today to go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. My name is Mark Ruskin, registration number 14621. With me is John Head, co-counsel in this matter. I represent Mr. Holtzman, appearing here today only for purposes of discussing the jurisdiction.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gruson. Other counsel?
Good afternoon, Mr. Hobbs and others. My name is Michael J. Norton. I represent the protesters, Castilian et al., in the separately filed protest.
Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Hobbs. Hugh Thatcher, 32661, on behalf of the Honorable Bob Beaupre.
Thank you, Mr. Thatcher. Let me also introduce the people here at the table. In addition to our court reporter to my left is Maury Kanizer, Deputy Attorney General, who advises the Secretary of State. To my immediate right is Hillary Rudy of the Secretary of State's staff, and to my far right is Rose Sanchez, also of the Secretary of State's Elections Division. As I indicated in my Monday memorandum, the first thing, I think the first order of business is to address jurisdictional issues. It's not clear to me whether or not the Secretary of State can consider, well, first of all, Mr. Gruskin's notice of objection state, Mr. Holtzman questions whether or not the Secretary of State can hear a protest. And as I indicated in my Monday memorandum, it's a little unclear to me whether or not the other whether I have jurisdiction over the other protests as well. So what I'd like to do is first hear from counsel on the jurisdictional issues. Specifically, I'd like to know whether they think that I do or whether I can proceed or not proceed to hear any protest or the notice of objections from Mr. Beaupre. And I'll start with Mr. Gruskin if you wish to address the jurisdictional issues. I'd like to just find out if you do have anything that you'd like to provide me in addition to the written notice of objections.
I think, Mr. Hobbs, at this point, I'd like to reserve any comment for the arguments that will be made by counsel for the putative protesters, in as much as we got the Mr. Norton's protest via fax maybe an hour ago, haven't seen Mr. Thatcher's. I really don't know what they're in a position to say, whereas I think our position is spelled out black and white, and at least according to Mr. Norton, already had an opportunity to review our for our letter that was submitted. So if it's all right, I'd like to reserve comment.
Could I ask you one question about the notice of objections that you did file?
Sure.
I just like some clarification, if you can. I'm not real clear on whether I should consider that a protest or not. I understand that you object to the Secretary of State proceeding on jurisdictional grounds, but should I consider that a protest under 14909 without jurisdiction to proceed, or should I not consider it a protest?
Mr. Hobbs, I think that the letter that was delivered to this office on June 6th certainly satisfies the jurisdictional requirements for a protest letter. But it seems to me that until court of law instructs the Secretary and the parties as to whether or not there is jurisdiction, it's premature to consider our protest letter or the other two letters that have been submitted as anything. Obviously, it's been submitted to your office in the event that a court rules that it does not have jurisdiction. So it's certainly preserving that argument. But other than that, frankly, it would have been malpractice had I not submitted it, since no one in my law firm really encourages that kind of activity. We submitted it to you for purposes of preserving the right to argue the substance of our concerns to the court, indicate it's not inclined to hear them.
Okay, thank you. And I will give you another opportunity after the counsel for the other protesters have presented their arguments.
Thank you.
And then I don't know whether Mr. Norton or Mr. Thatcher would like to go next. I'll leave it up to you. So, Mr. Norton.
It may be somewhat out of order for me to go in light of your, Mr. Hobbs, your memorandum of, I believe, June 5, which articulates the position that only Mr. Holtzman may file a protest and only Mr. Beaupre may appear. I don't represent either of those parties. I represent individual Republican eligible electors who are greatly concerned about the integrity of this process. I don't have any comments on the jurisdictional issue outside of the statement that we have timely submitted a petition in protest with a considerable number of attachments, a duplicate copy, hard copy of which I have given to you and is there before you, and I respectfully request to make that part of the record meetings at this point. We believe that I'm not sure if Mr. Bruce can answer your question about whether his letter was a protest.
I'm sorry, sir. I'm having trouble hearing you, but is it possible we could get the air possibly lowered or off?
We can look into it. I know that is a problem on that end.
About do I need to talk up? Is that your problem?
Yes, sir. If you could speak louder.
Okay.
Thank you.
Are you up with me?
There's a fan over here that makes it real hard on that end of the room.
Do I need to repeat anything?
Yes, sir. I got you to speak for saying that I'm not sure of that, sir.
I'm not sure of...
Excuse me for interrupting. Would it help if you move down this way? Or you've got your equipment, so...
It's all right. I've got some type of cord, but...
And we're also recording the proceeding as well, so, yeah.
Okay, we'll be recording still.
Okay. We'll just try to speak up.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I will try to speak up. Can you hear me better now if I get closer to the mic?
Thank you.
I think where I was and where the court reporter seems to think I was my observation that I'm not sure Mr. Gruskin answered your question, Mr. Hobbs, about whether his letter was a protest. I think that's a threshold issue that has to be answered so that it can be determined by you at this juncture. We, however, believe that the Secretary of State has jurisdiction for the purposes of this protest and that the protest we have filed on behalf of the individual electors is appropriately filled under the statute 14909. We do not agree, as you know, with the, and as our petition states, with the Secretary's interpretation that only Mr. Holtzman may file a protest and only Mr. Beaupre may respond. Our protest identifies as many as 10,000 additional signatures, which we believe the Secretary of State should have rejected but did not reject, and while it may be somewhat unusual to be here in support of the Secretary of State's determination of insufficiency, we did not comment, except in the broadest sense, on the rejected signatures, we respectfully believe we have the right to comment on other matters before this, before you, Mr. Hobbs.
Mr. Norton, I am having some difficulty with that notion that someone who agrees with the decision can file a protest of that decision. The way I understand your protest is you do agree with the ultimate decision, with the outcome. What you disagree with is some of the underlying facts that went into that decision. Is that correct?
Well, I have to say I disagree with the entire decision because it's based on faulty facts. Therefore, I'm in disagreement with the Secretary of State's decision, and I'm also in disagreement with the underlying facts.
But even if,
and in the terms of your memo, which seems to open the door for people who disagree with the Secretary of State's decision, we do.
Okay. And I'm still concerned that even if I were to agree with you on all of the grounds for rejecting signatures that were previously accepted by the Secretary of State, the outcome would be the same.
Well, the outcome may be the same, but for different and additional reasons. Mm-hmm. We believe we have the right to speak on the issue. It's really up to you to decide. I find nothing in the statute that precludes us from protesting.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Thatcher?
Mr. Hobbs, if I may, I'd like to confine my comments right now to the jurisdictional question with respect to filing received from Mr. Holtzman. I think that letter filed on behalf of Mr. Holtzman likely does constitute protest, notwithstanding disclaimer in the letter that says it's not protest. And because of that ambiguity, as well as the ambiguity in the memorandum issued by your office on Monday of this week, Mr. Beaupre essentially felt compelled to file a protest. But at this point in time, Mr. Beaupre takes no position with respect to the Secretary's jurisdiction over his protest, if that's what it is.
No position on which?
On the protest, the letter filed by Mr. Gruskin, if that is in fact protest.
Okay.
And I'd like to reserve comment on the jurisdiction over Mr. Beaupre's protest at a later time, if in fact this proceeding continues to move.
Well, I would like for you to go ahead and comment on that because what I'm likely to do is consider all of the jurisdictional issues together. I did consider the possibility of segregating this and first considering just the original notice of objections from Mr. Holtzman, but at this point I'd rather hear other jurisdictional issues as well.
I understand. In that case, my comments now apply only to the protest filed by Mr. Beaupre.
Okay.
I think that CRS 14909 needs to be viewed in the context of all of Colorado's election laws and not simply as one statutory provision. And based on that review, I think the Secretary does have jurisdiction to review Mr. Beaupre's protest of the notice issued by the Secretary to Mr. Holtzman. When 14909 refers to a statement of sufficiency, I think it's simply referring to the process by which a secretary rejects or accepts a candidate. A rejection of a candidate is still a statement of sufficiency. It's just saying that the candidate did not meet the sufficiency requirements. And I think the mere fact that the secretary calls it a statement of insufficiency or other like term really elevates form over substance for the purposes of the election laws. And in that light, it's important to note that CRS 11107 gives the secretary the authority to interpret and administer the election laws. And the interpretation that the secretary previously voiced in the memorandum of June 5, I think is consistent with the secretary's mandate. Administrative agencies such as the secretary's office have a specialized expertise in a particular area for a reason, designed to encourage efficient government. And allowing a review of any notice of sufficiency or insufficiency presented by the secretary to a person who's trying to get on the ballot by petition allows an efficient review of that process before a very expensive lawsuit is subsequently filed in the district court, if in fact the party so chooses to go there. And I think that the expertise of the secretary is properly applied to reduce that potential for further litigation prior to the next step being taken. And for that reason, I think that the secretary does have jurisdiction to review a protest under 14909 of a notice of insufficiency. Now, with respect to Mr. Beaupre, 14909 does not limit the persons who may protest. I don't think that the section stands independent, however, of the traditional notions of standing in civil court. And those criteria, I think, are satisfied here for Mr. Beaupre. An interested person, I think there's a case in controversy. I think it's right for decision. So in that respect, Mr. Beaupre would be a person who would be permitted to bring a protest under 14909.
Mr. Thatcher, let me ask you a couple of questions, if I could. First of all, I'm in my own mind, I'm trying to think of an analogy here to the appellate process. That, and I don't know whether that's whether it's valid to make that kind of analogy, but at least in concept, it seems to me that what you're asking as a protester is sort of like prevailing at the trial court with respect to the outcome, but appealing it anyway because you weren't happy with some of the factual findings at the trial court. And so far as I'm aware, normally that would not be an appeal that would be allowed. And that's sort of what it seems like you're doing.
I'm sure if I thought long and hard enough, I could find a hypothetical that was outside the example you proposed. But I think it depends, frankly, on whether the notice issued by the secretary is analogous to the findings of fact issued by a trial judge. And to be perfectly honest, I don't know the answer to that question.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the latter.
I think that it depends on whether the notice issued by the secretary is analogous to findings of fact issued by a trial judge. Or if, in fact, the notice in its entirety is something that may be protested, notwithstanding the fact that the ultimate result may be the same as already set forth in the notes. I need to explain that further. I certainly can. If you look at the document and say that's a notice of insufficiency or that's a notice of sufficiency, and that's all that is, i.e. the last sentence of that document is what is operative here, then perhaps your example is correct. But if there are substantive areas within that notice that have a material impact upon a protester, independent of the final conclusion at the end of the document, then I think it may be properly challenged.
Let me ask you one other question that relates, really sort of a practical question, I guess. Suppose you're right that I have jurisdiction to go forward with a protest from somebody who agrees with the Secretary of State's determination here. Practically speaking, I'm concerned about whether it makes sense to just do that anyway, because where I think we stand is one way or the other, Mr. Holtzman is not going to present evidence here sufficient to overturn the Secretary of State's determination. So the outcome after today is likely to be that statement of insufficiency, or whatever it should be called, is going to stand, and then a court will review that. So what would be the practical benefits of hearing evidence as suggested by the protesters here, for Mr. Beaupre and also the designated electors, when that will have to probably be redone when there's a judicial review? It seems like a waste of time to go forward.
I understand. I know, Mr. Hobbs, that one of the issues that's frequently before your agency is the issue of administrative exhaustion, and that a party must exhaust administrative remedies prior to proceeding to the district court. Now, given the fact that 14909 is silent on who may or may not bring a protest, I think that at a later time, I would be hesitant to say to my client, point blank, there is no threat of the other side raising the doctrine of exhaustion of remedies. It's always out there. Now, if you're kind enough to put on the record that any attempt here is futile and that there will be no change, I think that's a different question, because futility is one of the exceptions to the requirement that parties exhaust their administrative remedies.
I don't have any other questions, so thank you, Mr. Thatcher.
Nothing further.
I would like to hear from Mr. Norton. And Mr. Norton, I'm not sure I was clear, really, that I did want you to go ahead and address the jurisdictional issues on your protest as well. So,
Mr. Hobbs, the last question you asked of Mr. Thatcher is one that I think perhaps you asked me and I just didn't understand it in context. But I would like to weigh in on that question, and that is, what good does it do to raise a protest that might cause you to look at something that the Secretary has not heretofore looked at, i.e. the rejected signatures. And by rejected signatures, I mean the signatures the Secretary has already determined to be ineligible for a variety of reasons that caused Mr. Holtzman's efforts to petition onto the primary ballot to fall short in at least this first congressional district and the 7th congressional district. As I at least understand the section on protest 909, there's not a whole lot of authority on the issues that we're talking about, if any. There may be, and I've missed it, but I'm given to believe there isn't any. I do not believe that the section on protest limits what may be protested to a protest of a decision the Secretary has made or facts the Secretary has found in reaching that decision. I believe, and hence the petition in protest filed by my folks, I believe that the language is so broad that the protest can be one of essentially seeking to have the Secretary consider even more evidence than the Secretary appears to have considered in reaching the underlying decision. In this case, on, I guess, June 1 or whatever the date was, of the Secretary's notice of insufficiency. Implicit and inherent in this analysis is the idea that in a protest, evidence must be presented to counter, I guess you will, could say, the Secretary's determinations as to the rejected signatures, for sure. That's what Mr. Holtzman is going to want to do, I would assume. But likewise, because the language of the protest section is so broad, a like obligation rests on the Secretary of State to consider evidence that is raised by protesters of evidence of facts the Secretary did not consider in reaching the decision.
The section is just, quite frankly, silent on the scope of this review, but it is our position, my position, that 909 enables and entitles and, in fact, mandates the Secretary to consider not simply evidence relating to facts that were the basis upon the decision of insufficiency, but also facts properly raised in a timely filed protest such as ours. Does that make my position any clearer?
I think it helps. I think I could agree with you if Mr. Holtzman in this case were to go forward in this proceeding and present evidence in an attempt to rebut the Secretary's rejection of signatures, because then your clients would be at risk, because if Mr. Holtzman were successful in this hearing in overcoming enough rejected signatures and therefore the Secretary's determination were overturned in this hearing, it would be unfair for me not to allow you to present evidence on the other side.
That is precisely correct, and for the same exhaustion of administrative remedies principles that Mr. Thatcher raised, that's why we've done this. Now, from the get-go, I think that the initial question, Mr. Hobbs, that you raised was, do we have a proper protest from Mr. Holtzman here before us, is something that needs to be answered, because if there isn't, then I'm not sure what my position would be with regard to the consideration of the material that we have submitted, but it certainly changes the landscape. As I recall from reading the newspapers this morning, Mr. Holtzman, in a news conference yesterday, announced that he was not filing a protest and was bypassing the Secretary of State. I don't know why we're here on that aspect, if that's the case.
Thank you. Mr. Gruskin, having heard arguments of counsel, then would you like to respond to those?
Mr. Hobbs, with all due deference to people from the journalism industry who are in the room, this issue isn't being tried based on what was or wasn't said in newspapers. This is being tried based on what's in the pleadings. And I don't know what Mr. Holtzman may or may not have said or whether it was accurately reported. Frankly, it doesn't make any difference. The question is whether or not the matter before you is properly before you. Let me suggest this. Counsel for the two putative protesters seem befuddled by the statute, saying it doesn't really provide any clear direction. Let me suggest to you, maybe as to my own small mind, it does. It's easy. And here's how it's easy. The protest statute says, a petition that has been verified and appears to be sufficient shall be deemed valid unless a protest is filed. Okay? A petition that appears to be sufficient. The suggestion before you is that that's just not clear. That could mean insufficient, too. Well, if that's the case, then why did the General Assembly in its wisdom in 1-4-908 paragraph 3 direct the Secretary to undertake a review of a candidate petition and find it to be sufficient or insufficient? And once she comes to that decision, the statute further says that she is obligated to send a notification to the candidate of its of the petition's sufficiency or insufficiency. So the legislature had the presence of mind in section 908 to know that there were two options. But in section 909, I guess they just forgot. Well, I don't think they just forgot. And I refer you specifically to other petition statutes where the legislature doesn't forget. What comes to mind is 1-40-118(1), which is the initiative petition statute. And there the legislature knew what it was doing. And what it said was that a protest may be filed, quote, as to whether the petition has a sufficient number. So when the legislature wants to posture the right of protest as a function of sufficiency or insufficiency, it says that. And it says it clearly. It knew what it was doing. And I would suggest to you there was an awfully good reason for only providing the right of protest when a petition is sufficient. When a petition is sufficient, it is deemed valid, and therefore the candidate is presumed to have deserved a place on the primary ballot. In the event that that is proven to be incorrect, there are obvious remedies that will harm no one, but we don't count the votes cast for that individual. Where you have, though, an insufficient petition, there is a need, frankly, and your office is experiencing the yin and yang here, the need to both address protests and resolve who's on the ballot for purposes of certification. And I would suggest to you that the legislature anticipated that there ought to be an expedited process, this general process that's provided under the election code. As a matter of fact, it even included reference to 1-1-113 in the review portion. I believe that's section 911 of the petition section. But you have other cases to hear, you have other review to do, and you have a ballot to certify. Now, I would argue that the legislature wasn't unknowing or unthinking in the remedy that it provided, but specifically decided that the secretary ought to focus her efforts in a timely way on candidates. And frankly, under this statute, if the secretary wanted to, she wouldn't have to consider our protest until after she certified the ballot. That's a problem. Now, your office has been very solicitous, frankly, of the parties and very interested in meeting the certification deadline. But another secretary could reach another result. And for that reason, the legislature, I believe, foreclosed that other result. I would also suggest to you that it's a waste of resources for this office to undertake a second review where it is basically a cumulative presentation of a decision the secretary's already come to. It's not about convincing you or the secretary that this petition is insufficient. The protesters want to convince you it's more insufficient. And the legal change in resulting from their presentation will be, I don't know. I can't think of it. Lastly, I would suggest to you that with the pendency of the court action, where there is a clear direction to pursue an administrative remedy, you can't go to court independently. But where there is no clear direction, and where there is that judicial remedy, if you begin to contemplate these protests, and the district court contemplates the Holtzman protests, there may be very different standards and very different conclusions as to the same set of facts, as to what signatures are good and what signatures are not. And then what do we do? Who was right and who was wrong? One of the counsel pointed out that the secretary's office is deemed to be expert. But on the other hand, if the reviewing court decides what the standard is, can the secretary come to any sort of independent conclusion? We could end up with major conflicts, both in the conclusions reached and in the methods. And I think that would be problematic. I would lastly suggest to you, if I could approach, I'd like to hand you a letter that I received earlier.
You have copies for counsel also.
This is a letter that I received from Mr. Norton, transmitting the cover of his protest. And in the last paragraph, he indicates that he and his clients intend to intervene in any action you file. So the question is, if Mr. Norton is going to be heard in district court and before the Secretary of State, why does he need both forums? In any event, he doesn't dispute the fact that he will get to be heard. So why in the world should he make two presentations, which again could result in two different conclusions? There's no suggestion on the part of the Holtzman campaign that there's going to be an effort to somehow foreclose the opportunity for either the Beaupre campaign or Mr. Norton and his citizens to be heard. The goal here is to allow anybody to be heard, I suppose, as long as you decide they should be, and it meets the procedural needs of this hearing. But that's the point. let's let the process that's set forth in statute take its course. If this petition was sufficient, Mr. Thatcher and Mr. Norton would be properly before you. I don't think the legislature committed a gross error when it crafted Section 909. It knew what it was doing. It did what it did for a purpose, and it used language that has specific meaning. So specific, in fact, that the Secretary's letter isn't deemed, I think as Mr. Norton pointed out, maybe it was Mr. Thatcher, a letter of sufficiency. It's deemed a letter of insufficiency. So I would suggest that your jurisdiction to consider any protest at this point is nil, that everyone has preserved their rights by filing a letter. Let's go have the discussion where we can have it quickly and expeditiously, in conjunction with your office, about whether or not these petitions.
Let me ask a couple of questions, and I do want to questions to try to help me understand your arguments just a little bit better. Let me start with maybe just a general observation. I know it may be hard for some in concept for people to think, why is this statute, why is 14909 there at all? Why would the Secretary of State be reviewing her own decision? It seems like a conflict of interest. Now, I think the answer is that at the administrative level, there's an opportunity there for the Secretary of State to correct her errors. And that's perfectly normal in administrative proceedings. What I'm having some difficulty understanding, I mean, you indicated that you think the legislature knew exactly what they're doing, and I'm having trouble understanding what the intent of the legislature was there. I do understand the argument that 14909 clearly speaks just to situations where there appears to be a sufficient number, does not speak to the situation at all. But what is the rationale? I'm really having trouble understanding, because if the legislature had been making a conscious decision here, it seems like they could have, in fact, said something expressly about this situation. I don't see anything that covers this. And in fact, it seems contrary to the usual rule that if you're going to let the Secretary of State correct issues where there's a statement of sufficiency, correct errors where there's a statement of sufficiency, why not let her correct errors where there's a statement of insufficiency as well? Isn't there the same interest there? Help me understand that.
Well, I think that the legislature, it has to be presumed that the legislature knew what they were doing, even if we can't explain it in the aftermath. That's kind of our full stop. Why shouldn't the Secretary be permitted to hear an insufficient petition? My own sense, as I think I voiced, that a Secretary who was looking to keep a particular candidate off the ballot would be able to delay the hearing for the full period provided by statute, certify the ballot, and frankly, where would the candidate end up? Ding! District court, to try and get a position on the ballot. I think that the time that is required, and I've been through this a few months, the time that's required to do a protest hearing well requires the capacity to subpoena witnesses, to take testimony, to brief the legal issues, to hear the evidence, and to make legal arguments. And frankly, Mr. Hobbs, I don't know, even if this petition had been deemed sufficient, if you would have been able to do all of that within the 2 days before your certification deadline. So I think I have to presume that the legislature knew what it was doing, even if it was inadvertent. The door that's open is a broadly construed right of access to the courts to make sure that the Secretary's acts comply with the law. And that's all we're asking.
And maybe this is just an observation. I think it would have been clearer if the legislature, in making this perhaps conscious decision, had just gone ahead and included a sentence that said, in cases of insufficiency, the parties will proceed under 11113. Why not just go ahead and say that? So that's, I know we can't speculate.
At the point at which I can divine that sort of legislative intent, I'll move on to another.
Let me ask you one other question. So far as I'm aware, since I've been in my position, there have been a number of instances where statements of insufficiency have been the subject of protests that the Secretary of State has considered. Most recently, in my experience in the 2004 election, I'm aware of at least two. John Heckman, the candidate for U.S. Senate, the Secretary of State initially found that the petitions were insufficient, and then he filed a a protest, and the Secretary of State actually denied the protest. Another one at the same time was Carol Chambers, a candidate for DA. The Secretary of State found that petition insufficient. She filed a protest. The Secretary of State reversed her decision, put her on the ballot. Most recently, in November of last year, I think in a recall election for the ninth, or preceding a recall election for the ninth judicial district attorney, Martin Beeson his candidate petition was initially ruled insufficient. He filed a protest under 14909. The Secretary of State considered it, reversed her decision, and he was on the ballot, and in fact, he won. So I'm wondering, my question is, given what I think is the precedent, does that have any value here? I'm not aware that anybody's challenged it, but I'm just wondering if I should give any weight to the fact there appears to be some precedent.
You know, I think at the end of the day, the important thing is that the process proceeds in an expedited way and that the result is one that is perceived as a credible result. And in those instances, it evidently was the determination of the parties to vest the decision, knowing all the while, in the Secretary's lap, knowing all the while that they could go to the district court. In this instance, well, if this weren't so highly charged, you wouldn't have two protests to an already insufficient petition lodged in the office. The Secretary obviously has the capacity, and we believe the fair nature and tendencies to decide them. But if we submit it to your jurisdiction, I wonder which lawyer would sue over the legitimacy of that decision because the Secretary didn't have capacity. And so, frankly, this is something of a preemptive strike to make sure that the Secretary doesn't come to a decision only to have it invalidated, because none of the cases that you're talking about were ever tested in court after. I guess different lawyers look at this statute differently. But in looking at 909 myself, I am hard-pressed to see how a credible argument is made that the Secretary has the capacity to hear this, particularly in light of what 908 says, particularly in light of what the initiative statute says. When the legislature wants the Secretary to review insufficient petitions, it says so. And I just don't see any indicator in this statute that the legislature thought that the Secretary was going to have this job. And there may have been something different about candidate petitions than initiative petitions, or the timing, or the certification issues, or the political sensitivity that led the legislature to come to the conclusion. I don't know that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And let me hear from counsel in response to Mr. Gruskin's remarks. Mr. Norton.
Mr. Hobbs, I think just a couple of additional thoughts in response to what I heard from either you, Mr. Hobbs, or Mr. Gruskin. First of all, it doesn't really matter how highly charged this is. This is about the rule of law, the Constitution, and the laws of the state of Colorado. Mr. Holtzman has to play by those rules. As you indicated, this process is about giving the Secretary an opportunity to fix errors, or correct errors, I think we phrased it. Those errors could be either way, and the Secretary is obliged to hear evidence that rejected signatures should not have been rejected, and that accepted signatures should have been rejected. That is why we are here as a part of this rule of law process. Now, Mr. Gruskin makes much of my letter, which was faxed to him earlier today, and the paragraph that he drew attention to that suggests we intend to intervene in any action. It is Mr. Gruskin and his client, Mr. Holtzman, who has said they will bypass the Secretary of State and immediately file a civil complaint. There would be nothing for us to intervene in if they choose not to file a civil complaint. It's that civil complaint that they have said they will file that we would propose to intervene in, to which this paragraph is referring. If there's no civil complaint, there's no opportunity for us to be heard that second time if, in fact, we are not satisfied with what we derived from this first time. But we do believe that this first time is an opportunity by which the Secretary is obliged by law to hear not just Mr. Holtzman's contentions that signatures that were rejected should not have been rejected, but our contentions that signatures that were accepted should also have been rejected, and correct those errors so that the Secretary's determination from this hearing
may be as correct as it reasonably is possible to be.
Thank you. Mr. Thatcher, do you have anything to add?
I'm going to restate that my comments previously were purely on the question of whether the Secretary had jurisdiction over the protest brought by Mr. McRae.
I'm going to try with her, sir.
Sure. I'd like to say
whether the Secretary had jurisdiction over.
The Secretary has jurisdiction over the protest filed by Mr. Beaupre, and that Mr. Beaupre takes no position on the jurisdictional question in respect to Mr. Holtzman's protest.
Thank you. Having heard the arguments, I'm going to go ahead and issue some findings and conclusions, and I will follow it up with a written decision within 72 hours, although hopefully it'll be well before that, hopefully by Friday morning. Number one, I find that the Secretary of State does have jurisdiction under 14909 to consider a protest of a statement of insufficiency. I recognize that the statute only speaks to statements of sufficiency. However, the statute then appears to be silent with respect to the process in situations as such as this, where the Secretary has made an initial determination that there was an insufficient number of signatures. And although I agree with Mr. Gruskin that it's hard, we can't divine the legislative intent, I can't see a principled reason at this point why the statute would allow an administrative remedy in the case where the Secretary has found a sufficient number of signatures, why there's an administrative remedy to correct errors there, but there would not be an administrative remedy in cases where the Secretary may have erred in making a determination of insufficiency. In any event, there is substantial precedent for the Secretary to consider protests for statements of insufficiency. I recognize that ultimately, and maybe very soon, a court may provide some guidance on this question. And so, not being persuaded that I don't have jurisdiction under 14909, I think I'd rather follow what has been the custom and what has been the precedent until there's a judicial guidance to the contrary. Having found that the Secretary of State has jurisdiction to consider a protest of a statement of insufficiency, I don't know whether that means the Secretary of State has concurrent jurisdiction with the court. That is, that whether or not in circumstances such as this, someone dissatisfied with a statement of insufficiency can go directly to court, or whether the Secretary of State has basically exclusive jurisdiction, or jurisdiction is under 14909 would be a prerequisite to the court's jurisdiction. But I don't think it's necessary for me to decide that. I think it is sufficient for me to decide that the Secretary of State does have jurisdiction in this case under 14909. The next question on my mind really is still whether or not the notice of objections filed by Mr. Holtzman constitute a protest for purposes of 14909. If it's to be considered a protest, then obviously Mr. Holtzman elected not to present evidence in support of that protest, and therefore the protest is denied because the burden is on the protester under Section 14911 to provide evidence to overturn the Secretary's decision. If Mr. Holtzman's notice of objections is not to be considered a protest under 14909, in any event, the Secretary's determination therefore stands, and the next step would be at least the opportunity for a judicial review under 1-1-113. So with regard to the the protests that have been submitted by Mr. Beaupre and electors Castilian, Woodis, Hoppe, and Worley. It seems to me that these protests are now moot since the Secretary's determination of insufficiency stands. I believe that there's no independent right under 1-4-909 for a candidate or other interested person to protest a Secretary's determination when they agree with that determination. In this case, Mr. Beaupre and the electors agree with the Secretary's determination. They only disagree with some of the underlying factual findings from the Secretary of State. And it may be, as I indicated earlier, that if Mr. Holtzman was in fact seeking a review here under 14909 and was proceeding to present evidence that possibly could lead to the Secretary of State to reverse her prior determination, then there probably ought to be an opportunity for people who agree with the Secretary of State's initial determination to present evidence that signatures were wrongfully accepted. But that's not the situation that we have today. And I don't see that there's really any point in going forward with that evidence, given that it does appear to be moot. So for those reasons, I find that the Secretary of State's determination of insufficiency stands, that the protest of Mr. Beaupre and the electors Castilian, Woodis, Hoppe, and Worley are denied. And I will issue a written decision, hopefully by the end of the week. And I think that resolves the issues. I will ask counsel if there's any questions, Mr. Gruskin.
Not sure I understand your decision, Mr. Hobb. Are you suggesting that in this hearing to address jurisdictional matters that no evidence was provided and therefore you're ruling against the Holtzman protest?
My understanding is Mr. Holtzman did not present any evidence in support of the statement of insufficiency, overturning the statement of insufficiency.
But the statute requires him to state his concerns in summary manner.
In the protest itself, but in the protest hearing would be the opportunity to provide evidence.
He didn't ask for evidence. And as a matter of fact, the notice said that this was about jurisdictional matter.
No, I don't think the notice said that. I think this is the hearing on under 14909. Now, you've raised jurisdictional issues, and I'm finding that the Secretary of State does have jurisdiction.
So if the Secretary has jurisdiction, are you willing to take evidence?
I provided an opportunity, but you indicated that you were not going to, and I think your letter indicates that you're not going to. So, I mean, I think what I quoted at the beginning was the statement from your notice of objections, that there's no basis for any further proceeding before the Secretary of State regarding these petitions. And there was no offer of going forward with evidence.
Because we were discussing the jurisdiction of your office to even hear this. So are you suggesting, you're not actually suggesting, that in discussing the jurisdiction I should have put on evidence before you made a jurisdictional decision that you could even hear evidence?
I was actually relying upon the statements in your notice of objection that there was no basis for jurisdiction, that you were not, that was the end of it as far as you were concerned. I had no reason to believe otherwise. Are you prepared? Let me just ask, are you prepared to go forward with evidence?
You actually, or maybe it was Mr. Kneiser, informed me that this would not be an evidentiary matter because you've got another hearing scheduled at 3 o'clock.
I did not inform you.
You're right. You did not. It was Mr. Kneiser.
Well,
is it true that you have another matter scheduled?
We have one, and my understanding is they will have to wait. We are prepared to go forward with evidence, but as I said, I don't think you were offering any evidence. What I anticipated at most, based on your notice of objections, was evidence might be submitted by the other protesters. And we were prepared to bump the 3 o'clock hearing.
So, well, it's at 2:25. That's the first I've heard about that. And it seems to me that your decision is what your decision is, but I would ask that you reconsider the decision as to the merits, because frankly, this is not a matter that could be addressed quickly enough for you to be able to reach a decision prior to the certification date, number one. Number two, to the extent that there was any sort of conversation about whether or not the merits were going to be addressed, the indications were that they were not going to be addressed. And number three, you were quite explicit in your comments, Mr. Hobbs, that this was going to, you've actually restricted counsel to dealing with jurisdictional matters. So if you decide on the merits, then I guess that we'll get a double shot at the district court under Section 113. But I will tell you that I think it would be inappropriate and ill-advised for the secretary to, in the context of a hearing on the jurisdiction of the parties before it, to rule on the merits.
Can I ask if I may, perhaps I misunderstood. I did understand that you were not prepared to go forward with evidence today. Did I misunderstand that?
No, you did not misunderstand that fact.
Okay. Are there any other questions from counsel?
But I will tell you this, Mr. Haas, if we were in fact in a position where we had been informed that this was going to be more than an hour and a half legal argument, we would have mustered our experts and various documents. But that information didn't come down. That would have been more than helpful.
Could you point me to the notice? I'm just starting to look at the notice of the hearing. Was there something in that said that this was limited to jurisdictional issues?
Your statements to counsel made it clear it was limited to jurisdictional issues, and it was supposed to address all jurisdictional issues.
Which I think I have. I mean, that certainly was my intent. If I left something out, I think I addressed jurisdictional issues not only with respect to your notice of objections, but also the protest from Mr. Beaupre and the designated electors.
I'm here to tell you that in informal conversations, it had been indicated to me that this was an hour and a half hearing. To the extent that it's an hour and a half hearing, there is no way that any of the three parties before you could put on any piece of significant evidence. If that was not the case, well, then I either misunderstood or, in fact, it was intended always to be a jurisdictional hearing.
Well,
and frankly, I think it's a rush to judgment. You don't need to make a decision now about the merits.
I assume you're referring to my memorandum on Monday, which was prior to any filings in this matter. And my memorandum on Monday set this hearing for 9 o'clock in anticipation that we would at least need all day. And I was prepared to go into the evening. Now, you informed me that you were unable to make a 9 o'clock hearing, and so I scheduled it for 1:30. I never said or never intended to imply that there would not be an opportunity for evidence. And I don't think there's any communication from my office that says otherwise. We only tried to accommodate your schedule.
Do you disagree that there's a 3 o'clock hearing schedule?
No, there is a 3 o'clock hearing, and as I said, we have been prepared to bump that if necessary.
Well, again, that may be your operating procedure, but none of that actually got down to the parties involved who have to produce evidence. So I will tell you, if that's your decision, we're happy to accept that as your decision, because we're going to ask the district court review anyway. But
right.
For the record, let me make it very clear that communications to counsel were made that this would be an hour and a half jurisdictional hearing, that we responded to that, and as a courtesy showed up, notwithstanding the specifics in our letter, and that there is no cause other than to get leverage in an appeal for you to rule on the merits, knowing that we are requesting a fair hearing of the substance of this petition. There is no reason that you need to rule today. Am I correct?
No, I think as I tried to express in my ruling, without deciding whether or not you submitted a protest or not, either way, the Secretary's decision stands today. That's my ruling, and I don't think you disagree with that.
Well, I will tell you this. As to a ruling on the substance of our protest, of our letter of June 6th, it seems to me that it satisfied all the prerequisites for a protest. You never asked whether or not whether there was evidence. I mean, I'll rely on the transcript for that. And frankly, we've been trying to operate with the Secretary's office in good faith, keeping you in communication about our plans. I find that when there's one communication about the nature and the time of this hearing, and in fact, it ends up being something very different, is problematic. But I will also tell you that since you never had jurisdiction in the first place, it really isn't all that problematic. The judge will have a fresh bite.
Right.
So this is, I think, a matter of miscommunication. And for my role in that, I apologize. But I will tell you that since I disagree with your position that the precedent of this office has any legal meaning whatsoever, and that the fact that this office and other parties have been willing to ignore the clear statute is not binding on the Holtzman campaign and will not in any way curtail the presentation we intend to make in this report.
I understand. Thank you. And I apologize if there's some miscommunication. As I said, I think we just tried to accommodate your schedule. We were prepared to go forward. You know, one of my initial questions here today was what you filed a protest or was it not? And basically, my ruling makes no finding on that. Just says either way, the Secretary's determination stands. So, at least it was my understanding that leaves you where you wanted to be. But perhaps I'm mistaken. So, Mr. Norton, did you have anything that you wanted to ask?
No, sir. I'm not thinking for it.
Okay. Thank you. Is there anything further from counsel, Mr. Thatcher? Are you okay?
Mr. Hobbs?
Mr. Head, if you'll maybe come to the podium, please. Okay.
Thank you. For the record, my name is John F. Head. I'm co-counsel of Mr. Gruskin with the Holtzman campaign. And I would like, for the record, to have Mr. Kneiser state in the record what he told Mr. Gruskin that would be the subject matter of this hearing this afternoon. Because he's been silent on this issue, and the communications that came to us came from him. Could I ask for that statement to be made?
Let me take a little recess. You know, I actually do want to think about some of the comments from Mr. Gruskin and your request as well. I will take a little recess here. Mr. Thatcher, you have anything that you want to add?
Brief comment. Mr. Hobbs, we were ready here today to present evidence.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Mr. Beaupre was ready here today to present evidence. Our understanding was this was a full hearing.
Thank you.
What was your last name, sir?
Our understanding was that this was a full hearing on the merits.
So let's take about a 5-minute break, and I'll be right back with you.
Sure. Sorry, break, Mr. Hobbs. I would just like to add an identical comment. I was not advised of anything other than the change of the time of the hearing from 9 to 1:30. And I had presumed and understood that this was a evidentiary type hearing. I also understood that I might not be able to participate, as the chair has apparently ruled. And so I just want to join in the comments.
Okay, thank you. For the record, we'll break, and the time is 2:36. Thanks. Okay, let's resume. For the record, the time is 2:52 p.m. When we broke, Mr. Head had asked for a statement from Mr. Kneiser about a communication, so I wanted to give Mr. Kneiser an opportunity if he wanted to provide a statement in response to Mr. Head's request.
Certainly. I did get a phone call this morning from Mr. Gruskin. It was a very short phone call. In essence, we discussed he talked to me a little bit about what Mr. Holtzman's campaign was planning, particularly with regard to proceeding in court. I did state to him that there would be a hearing at 3 o'clock this afternoon, and that we would be discussing jurisdiction at the 1:30 hearing set on the Holtzman matter. I frankly do not recall saying that it would be only discussion on jurisdiction, but I will say for the record that Mr. Gruskin and I have worked long and well and cordially over the years, and I'm not sure whether it was, you know, my misstatement or his misunderstanding, but, you know, clearly I do not recall intending to or stating that it would be only jurisdiction, but to be frank, I don't recall all of the details of the conversation, and historically, as I said, I've worked well with Mr. Gruskin, and I certainly have no doubt about his good faith or integrity in making the statements that he made.
Thank you. And I do appreciate the concerns of Mr. Gruskin, and I don't want, in fairness to Mr. Gruskin, I don't want any possibility of unfairness to him or his client. And, you know, I feel badly about it. I've certainly worked with Mr. Gruskin for many years and do agree that there's, he's a very ethical attorney, and I know he's operating in good faith, and I'm very concerned about his feeling that he was misinformed. So I think if Mr. Gruskin wants to present evidence, I think an opportunity should be afforded to do that. We could either begin now, but there is another hearing scheduled. I think it's pretty clear it would take a substantial period of time. It may make more sense to begin tomorrow morning if there's going to be evidence presented in this proceeding. And, you know, I'd originally anticipated that it would take at least a day, maybe much longer, I don't know, but at least a full day. So what I would propose, if Mr. Gruskin, if you want to present evidence, we would probably want to start tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock and then proceed for as long as it takes. Sure. Yeah. Mr. Gruskin.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. And I just want to say for the record, not making this appear to be kind of a love fest or anything. That I obviously have worked with Mr. Hobbs, with Mr. Kneiser, for, well, since I had hair. And our relationship has been a professional one, I anticipate that. My memory is not so good that I can repeat a conversation that I had 6 hours ago. So I related what I thought my impression was. And I appreciate that. I appreciate your openness. Frankly, while we might be interested in the opportunity to present evidence, frankly, as you know, we don't think the Secretary has jurisdiction. And if we commence this rulemaking, I just want to pose an issue to you. If we commence this rulemaking, this review of the Secretary's decision, I think the argument would likely be made that we have somehow accepted the Secretary's jurisdiction. We do not. But we think it's more appropriate for the Secretary to suspend an adjudication until a court can say, yes, you ought to go ahead and hear that evidence, or no, it's right that I ought to. So we acknowledge that the Secretary may have jurisdiction, but at this point, it seems, and my objection was really rooted in there was no need for you to rule on our letter of objection. So I would acknowledge to you that should we be ordered to do so, we will come to that. I would ask for your forbearance for a slight amount of time so that we can get the right judicial direction. And frankly, if we get that direction and we need to commence the proceeding here, we'll absolutely be in front of you, and it will be more than a day. but I don't want to undertake part of a process only to have a judge say, why are you in two forums at once? Because we think that's a problem.
Would it be, and I just want to make sure I understand, that what would make sense from your view is if my ruling today were limited to a finding that the Secretary of State has jurisdiction, but suspend consideration of the merits, can suspend further proceedings, subject to an opportunity for Mr. Holtzman to pursue judicial remedies, or how help me just understand it a little better.
That's fair. I represent to you that we will be filing shortly district court. First issue we will ask the court to rule on is obviously what the Secretary needs to do in terms of the certification date. The second issue we will ask the court to rule on is whether or not the court has jurisdiction to hear our claim. If the court says no to the second question, if we, because I, as I think I said, that letter was intended as a placeholder to preserve our rights, we will come back here and we'll have the discussion. But we just don't want to have the discussion more times than we need to have, because we think that the real goal is to get the campaign underway and put all the technical stuff behind it. So I am hoping that Mr. Kaiser and I and Mr. Thatcher and Mr. Norton can get in front of a judge yet this week, get those answers to the Secretary. And one way or another, we'd be willing to be sending evidence to the judge or to you, Mr. Hobbs, on Monday.
And I'm certainly open to that, because I do think that it would really be troublesome to try to do this twice, you know, once here and once before a judge. And if that's, you know, and especially with the deadline for certifying the ballot coming up, there needs to be some resolution, and that certainly weighs on me quite a bit. So I'm certainly open to that solution, and I would like to hear from the other counsel to get their views. So, thank you.
The deadline for certifying the ballot is that you just mentioned?
It's this Friday.
Friday?
That's correct.
That being June?
June 9th.
And I guess what I would like to say, Mr. Hobbs, if you are inclined to change your order that I thought you issued before this debate on evidence began, which ended where it started, which is there is no evidence sent to you. If you are inclined to not rule as you did, leave this hearing open, we likewise would be desirous of coming back before you and arguing that we have a right to be here and a right to present our evidence at that point, for all the reasons and arguments that I stated before. I don't see that as a very efficient administrative procedure, and I don't think it fulfills your responsibilities of making a decision at this hearing based on what you have heard to this date. So I encourage and urge you to abide by the ruling that you announced at the outset.
Thank you. Mr. Thatcher?
Well, I certainly understand the desire to proceed as efficiently as possible. The question that arises in my mind from the proposal that Mr. Bruce put forth, whether we have final agency action for purposes of review in the district court, if in fact you suspend any decision of the Secretary pending a ruling of the court as to whether the Secretary has jurisdiction or not, which would then result in us back here before you doing this all over again before going back to the district court. And I think that kind of ping-ponging back and forth doesn't serve anybody's interest, frankly. Having said that, however, Mr. McRae will abide by the Secretary's decision if that is, in fact, what he decides to do.
Thank you.
This thing down.
Mr. Gruskin, can I ask you just a point of clarification? One of the, I think probably from the perspective of the Secretary of State, it really is critical to get a resolution in light of the deadline for certifying the ballot, to get a resolution as quickly as possible. What expectation can I have about your getting into court? I mean, are you planning or will you commit to doing that tomorrow?
The meeting has been drafted. It's undergoing a fine-tuning phase right now. So the answer to your question, Mr. Hobbs, is yes, we will be filing tomorrow.
Okay.
And as indicated, we will provide notice to the Attorney General, and to the extent that they want it, I'm happy to invite Mr. Norton and Mr. Thatcher to the party.
And in addition to the pleading tomorrow, what representation can you make for me as far as how fast you're prepared to proceed? Will you be able to begin presenting evidence this week?
Well, it depends what the judge tells us to do.
Right.
But the answer is yes. When the judge tells us to go, we'll go.
Well, I will then modify my prior ruling and suspend any ruling on the merits of the notice of objections filed by Mr. Holtzman, subject to further direction from the court, with the expectation that that Mr. Holtzman will file tomorrow, and that Mr. Gruskin, your effort will be to try to get a resolution as quickly as possible. If the matter is returned to the Secretary of State, you can't expect that we would be scheduling a hearing as soon as possible.
I understand that, and we will respond.
Okay.
Thank you,
Mr. Holtzman. I will do a written decision, but again, it'll probably be Friday. But nevertheless, I'll modify my prior remarks to that extent, and I don't know how much clarity that leaves, but I hope it's sufficient. Are there any questions about where we stand, Mr. Thatcher?
Mr. Hobbs, just to be clear, in your prior ruling, you ruled that the protests of Mr. Beaupre and the other electors represented by Mr. Norton were dismissed because there's no inherent right to challenge the Secretary's determination. And I believe, again, misunderstood, that your ruling was in part based upon the fact that you had dismissed Mr. Holtzman's claim on the merits. So I'd like to clarify exactly where we stand.
Thank you. And I would like to clarify that. Again, my ruling is that the Secretary of State does have jurisdiction, but I'm suspending further proceedings pending further direction from the court if it's coming. If, in fact, the matter is returned to the Secretary of State, let me back up. I withdraw my ruling denying the protests of Mr. Beaupre and the Republican electors. If, in fact, the matter comes back before the Secretary of State, then, in fact, it would be my intention to reconsider those protests. Now, I will tell you, and maybe this is unnecessary, probably administratively or procedurally, the way I would conduct it would be to provide an opportunity first for Mr. Holtzman to present his evidence and make findings on his evidence. And then if the findings were to sustain that protest based on Mr. Holtzman's evidence, at that point, then I would provide an opportunity for the other protesters to overcome that with evidence attempting to reject signatures previously accepted. But I first would want to see if there's evidence sufficient to overcome the Secretary's statement of insufficiency before hearing evidence from the other protesters. Is that
sufficient? I understand. That clarifies.
Okay.
No, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions, Mr. Norton?
Yes. In regard to what you just said, it seems to me that maybe this is a misunderstanding on my part or lack of experience, I suppose, on my part, but it seems to me that what you want to hear is evidence supporting the Secretary's decision to reject signatures, as well as evidence designed to overcome that decision to reject. In other words, either, theoretically at least, either of the protesters, I assume Mr. Holzman's not going to want to present evidence that there should be more signatures rejected, but either of the two protesters, along with the Secretary of State, would be desirous of presenting evidence to support the Secretary's decision with respect to the rejected signatures. Is that going to be possible?
That's correct. So I would first look at the signatures that were rejected, provide Mr. Holzman an opportunity to contest that, but I would provide the same opportunity to the other protesters to provide evidence with respect to those signatures that were rejected. Okay. Any further questions? If not, then we'll go ahead and conclude this hearing, and the time is 3:09 p.m. Thank you.